Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you for spending some time with me. For my next guest, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, a 2 million square foot vault with more than 5,000 years of art history on view, well, feels like her second home. Christine Colson started working at the Met in 1991 as an intern in the European Paintings Department. She returned in 1994 and over the course of the next 25 years rose through the ranks of the museum. She knows the museum, its art, and its architecture in a way most of us could never imagine. And imagine Christine does in her book, Metropolitan Stories, that brings us into a world where Picassos and Vermeers come to life, and they have opinions. Ghosts of donors hang around, and artifacts on display, like a centuries-old chair, now considered a priceless work, just longs for the days when they were of use in the world. Tonight at 6, Christine Colson will be in conversation with Barbara Boehm, curator of medieval art at the Met at the St. James Episcopal Church in Montclair, New Jersey. Tomorrow night at 6:30, she'll be doing a Q&A at the CUNY Graduate Center in Ellabash Recital Hall. The conversation will be moderated by Jennifer Ball, professor of early Christian and Byzantine art at CUNY, but Christine is in our studio right now. It's so nice to see you.
Thank you.
First of all, congratulations on finishing a book. That's fantastic.
Thank you.
What are your earliest memories of visiting the Met before you even worked there?
I think I probably share the same memories everyone does, which is kind of King Tut and the Egyptian collections and the allure of all of that. My favorite object, though, when I was young was Mary Magdalene's tooth, which is on display in the medieval galleries. It's literally a molar embedded in rock crystal. You know, one of those wonderful displays of faith that the Middle Ages had, that people believed was a relic of a saint. And I just loved the idea of something so ordinary being treated in this grand and beautiful way. And it was kind of creepy. And so that had a lot of allure for me.
Were you an art history person? Were you a history person?
I was an art history person. I'm very much an art history person who wasn't a very good art historian. So I went to graduate school in art history. But I wasn't a great researcher. I was good at thinking about works of art, which I think this book shows how far that can go. I was always, in my career at the Met, a kind of bilingual person, in the fact that I'm an organized creative person. So my jobs were always, one, to tell the Met story, a lot of writing for the Met, but also someone who could help the curators really achieve their vision. And I loved that work and loved their stories. But at the same time, for 23 years, these stories were also stewing in my head. And I took a year-long sabbatical from the Met to write this novel. And at that moment, it all came pouring out.
I was going to ask you, you know, I think anybody who has worked any place that has a culture to it, you think, oh, this would be great. Public radio, this would be a great novel. The Met, this would be a great novel. When did that start to become clear to you, that there was a story that you could tell, which would tell the story of the Met, but also be fiction?
Yeah, I think the stories over time kind of aggregate. It, like any culture, we have our own kind of family lore, and we have a way of talking about ourselves. These stories that are in this book, the kernels of truth throughout the book, are really based on stories that we have told over and over again. Like any kind of family Thanksgiving table, we would gather in the staff cafeteria and rehash this same kind of shared mythology that created our culture. And so it was less, you know, people have asked, did you keep a journal for those 23 years? Were you constantly scribbling and taking these ideas, you know, getting them ready to write this book? And in fact, you didn't have to write them down. It was like any kind of oral history, they were constantly repeated. And so stories that are collected in your mind sort of have that staying power. So I think of the let's see, chapter 3, which starts with the director of the Met, starts with him reading a memo, which was very much a real memo that I probably delivered back in my days of delivering mail as a young assistant there. It was probably 1996, and there was a meeting planned with Karl Lagerfeld, And this was a briefing memo about that meeting. And the memo said, Mr. Lagerfeld will bring his muse. The muse will not speak. Do not address the muse. And so once you have that experience, and my mind went right to thinking about, what if the director brought his own muse to that meeting? Like, would there be some kind of muse showdown? And with that in mind, you know, I crafted a story in which the director then is searching for a muse from the Met's collection. We've got plenty of them to choose from. So I think,
and there's kind of a casting call.
There's a little bit of a casting call, and there's 17 curatorial departments at the Met. So then there's probably muses in every one of them. So it was great fun to write, but it was the kind of story that made perfect sense in my imagination. So I think one of the things that happens when you live in a place and you're part of a culture, the Met is one of those institutions that people visit once in a while or once in a lifetime. And I got to live there for 25 years. And that allows you to kind of relax around the works of art and around the staff in a way that lets your imagination really take flight. And I think this book demonstrates where it went when it did that.
My guest is Christine Colson. The name of her book is Metropolitan Stories. You wrote a piece for the New York Times called Behind the Scenes at the Met, and you open with this great story about your son's first grade class. Will you share that story and why it's important to you and to this project?
So I had my son and his class come to the Met on a Monday. We used to be closed on Mondays, and so the great guide took them around, and she was trying to lure them in, you know, these little squirmy kids. And the galleries are empty, and she took them to see a Renoir painting in which this little girl is sitting on her dog. Which is a great idea to kind of hook them in. But just as she was talking about that painting, a lamper arrived. And a lamper is a guy who changes the light bulbs. And he came in driving this cherry picker and then expanded the kind of accordion fold to lift himself up to the 25-foot high ceilings. I mean, and Renoir did not stand a chance. These kids were mesmerized. And my son kind of sidled up to me and said, you know, Mom, you know that guy? And I said, yeah. He screamed out in the galleries, my mom knows that guy, in this way that showed that he was so proud with this affiliation to not a great painter or a great institution, but to the guy who works behind the scenes and does what is considered a pretty mundane task in a magnificent institution. And indeed, those lampers are heroes. They are the kind of rock stars of the museum, in that those are the people who kind of make it happen. And so what I really wanted to do in this book is to celebrate all the people who have devoted their lives to the museum in big ways and small ways, but with a kind of quiet dedication that really makes that museum hum.
I was interested also in the building itself, you know, as someone who comes in or went on every field trip as a kid because I grew up in the area, or you go because we're doing a piece about the Met or something exhibit. I want to know about the tunnels underground.
The tunnels, yes.
Tell me about these tunnels. You write about them a bit. I don't want to give too much away, but I'm really interested in them.
Yeah. So one of the things you get when you work there is a kind of physical ownership of that place and understanding the ins and outs, the back ways to get through the museum, up and down and across and over. And one of the places that is kind of the most mysterious and kind of the most creepy are the tunnels. The tunnels were originally water tunnels from the old aqueduct that was behind the New York Public Library. And so you go down, and now they're used for storage. I mean, and we used to go down to the tunnels once a year to basically store paperwork. But there's a lot of old stuff down there, not art, nothing important, but it's dusty and creepy and atmospheric. And when I wrote the story about the tunnels, I hadn't been there in about 10 years. So I had someone bring me back down there so I could experience it again. And they're just as strange as I remember. And so it was the perfect opportunity to write with the kind of magic that I've used in this book to talk about the possibilities of the Met. What could be unleashed if you really let your mind and your imagination run wild?
Well, you do, by the way. My guest is Christine Colson. The name of the book is Metropolitan Stories. The first story in the book, which sets the tone, we know right away, chair is hero. And it's told from the perspective of an 18th century armchair. Tell us a little bit more about this chair and what makes it so special.
You know, it's a remarkable chair that's not given a great spotlight within the museum. It's in a room, a gorgeous Rococo room in the Reitzman Galleries, which are the period rooms devoted to the 18th century. And it's in a room filled with gilded furniture and chandeliers and sparkly surfaces and the most magnificent dog bed you could possibly imagine. And everyone kind of focuses on those things. And off to the side is this chair. And it's beautiful and it's with its hot pink upholstery and its beautifully carved surfaces. But not particularly distinctive, except for the fact that it has its original upholstery. And to me, that distinguishes it in the sense that it really still holds the kind of juice of the 18th century, the dust and particles and dandruff of the 18th century. That, to me, that potency is still in that chair. And so you're not just looking at this is what a chair would look like in the 18th century. Mm-hmm. This is an 18th century chair with all its kind of dust and history and memory still in it.
Would you read a passage from that chapter? Chair is hero.
I remember back in Paris when a master carver sculpted me into coils and tendrils, decorations so florid that even my smoothest surface arched in acrobatic movement, swinging, reaching, bounding, wrapping with wisteria determination. Gold leaf coated each of these spiraling forms. The sheets of the precious metal, impossibly thin, floated onto my exposed wood like a soft rain, cool and tender. Silk velvet was then stretched across my curves, a fine bespoke suit, taut and precise, with glistening ornament along its edges. I can picture Louise Elizabeth's daughter, Isabella, age 8, on the day I arrived from France at the Ducal Palace of Colorno in Parma. It was 1749, and she stroked my crimson velvet with such care, trying to appear grown up and sophisticated. But I also remember when she curled herself within my arms and cried fat, messy tears, her knees tucked tightly beneath the panniers of her gown with its flowers and ribbons. I can still feel the heaving of her chest against my back as she shivered gently to the rhythm of her sobs. How I wish I could have swayed along with that pulsing sorrow to comfort her. Only 5 years later, Isabella's siblings, Ferdinand and Maria Luisa, would topple into me during audiences with their parents and pull at my gold trimmings, as clumsy and silly as any children, despite their finery. One time at the Met, a small boy, not more than 3 years old, wandered past the barriers in the Reitzman Galleries and headed straight for me. Almost 225 years had passed, but he reminded me so much of those toddlers back in Parma. Come on, little guy, I thought from behind the gallery ropes. You can make it. The boy's plump hands extended forward, propelled by his thick, tumbling waddle, his shoes clomping on the gallery floor. I felt like I was hanging from a cliff, waiting for him to grip my arm and save me. Then a breeze of moist heat floated past as his mother grabbed him at the very last second, just before he reached me. That was 1978. I still dream about it. I imagine the boy climbing up onto my seat, his pleasant folds and warm, springy pudge nestled between my arms, a small puddle of drool soaking into my velvet, the life of it racing through to my frame.
That is Chair is Hero, the first of the stories in Metropolitan Stories. And, you know, I mentioned to you when we were sitting down talking before the mics went on that I had read them and I'd read a couple out of order. You said, no, you're supposed to read them in order. The order is very important. tell me why.
I think so. I think that's what makes it a novel rather than a book of short stories is that I'm asking people to take great leaps with me. And I worked very hard on the structure in order to make them feel comfortable taking those leaps. I think the authenticity of the details that I have woven through the book, I never mess with the locations of works of art or the actual works of art. I try and create a certain stability and familiarity so that when I do kind of go off the rails when the chair starts talking, you feel comfortable enough to know that that's... That's exactly where we're going to go in each one of these situations. So as the book unfolds, characters repeat and and there are returns back to older stories. So that order was very important to me. And that structure really, I think, helps the reader.
Is there one piece of a work of art that you wrote about in this book that when people go to the Met after reading your book, they hope they'll see different, you'll hope they will see this piece differently or this part of the building or this part of the museum or?
I think there's a whole tour probably in this book that I think people could feel differently about these works of art. They're certainly not the masterpieces of the Met. They are very much the objects in the museum that speak to me personally and where I find solace and meaning. I think I'm surprised with the story of Adam, who is an early Renaissance sculpture that actually fell off its pedestal in 2002 and shattered and was rebuilt over the course of 11 years. It was the great trauma of my time at the museum and one that really shook us as an institution. But there was a part of me when that happened that did actually wonder, I wonder what it felt like for that sculpture when it was in the air. This thing that's never supposed to move actually suddenly is in motion. Not when it hit the ground, but that moment before, that moment of release after it started to move. And so I write about that and what that may have felt like for the object itself. And I think now when you look at Adam, it strikes me that a lot of people didn't know that, that have read this story, didn't know that Adam fell. And so they thought I made that up, which I think they thought was rather cruel. But in the end, he did fall. And so this was more my interpreting what that might have felt like. So I think a return to Adam might have an interesting flavor once you've read the book.
The name of the book is Metropolitan Stories. It is by Christine Coulson. Christine, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.